move to the third case today, which is Ricker v. Home Depot.
Before you start, I do want to say that I have rented things from Home Depot. I know there's classes, Illinois people who have. Whether I ever had one of these waivers and signed it or didn't sign it or what, I have no idea. I've rented a power washer every year for the last 4 or 5 years from Home Depot. And I just want to tell everybody that. I don't think it's not going to make any difference to me, and I don't think it's grounds for recusing myself in this case.
That appreciate said, that. I have no confessions tonight, but I appreciate it.
thank you on behalf of Home Depot.
On behalf of the plaintiffs, I can say now we have no objection, of course. I may proceed. May it please the court.
My name washer didn't work really well.
Yes, you may proceed.
My name is Jonah Orlovsky, and I represent the plaintiffs. The interesting fact in this case is that we have a Consumer Fraud Act claim that turns on an issue of contract interpretation. The reason for that is that the product that is being sold, the damage waiver, is a contractual provision. It's a promise. All it is what's in the contract. And the allegation that we've made is that that damage waiver does not provide any protection. Quite simply, it's a worthless product. There really isn't any dispute about what the damage waiver does. It's agreed that the damage waiver is going to protect you if the tool is damaged while you're using it properly, but it's not going to protect you, even if you buy it, if the damage occurs while you're using the tool improperly. So the question becomes, if you don't have the damage waiver, what are you responsible for under the contract? Are you liable for damage that occurs to the tool while it's being used properly?
Well, in this case, I'm having a little problem. Maybe I shouldn't, because there was no problem, and your client was not required to pay anything or anything else.
That's right, Your Honor. That's in the nature of insurance. You buy it. This is not technically insurance, but a damage waiver is conceptually the same as insurance. It's like medical insurance, car insurance, any kind of insurance. You buy that in case certain events happen, then the insurance should be there to cover you. But what we're saying is that this would never come into play. It had no value to you. You're willing to pay that additional 10% in case the tool is damaged. It's there to provide you some protection you wouldn't otherwise have. But if we can show that under no circumstances would that damage waiver ever provide protection, you've paid 10% out of your pocket for nothing. You've bought air. So that's the damage. You've paid 10% for insurance that doesn't provide you any coverage. The question then becomes, what does the contract do? What kind of liability does the contract impose if you're not buying the damage waiver? And you look at the language of the contract to see what did the parties intend in drafting the contract, really Home Depot, who obviously drafted this form contract. There are a couple of provisions we rely upon, but there's one provision that we think is sort of like a billboard saying here's what the contract intended, and that is paragraph 6 of the terms and conditions, which we call the repair or replacement clause. And it's a clause that deals with what's going to happen if a tool needs to be repaired or replaced. And that's obvious.
Let me ask you this. The Home Depot's brief has this example of using this garden tiller or something like that, and you're working it and you hit a rock and you break the thing. And they say that had you not had the damage waiver, you would be responsible then for that damage.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy the waiver, then you are relieved of any responsibility. You just bring it back and say, I was using it, I hit a rock, and I'm covered. If that is true, I mean, you say reading other parts of this contract, that would not expose you to any liability in the first place. Isn't that?
That's right. I think, well, let's start with the first thing. We're assuming that using a tiller in an area that has rocks, so a tiller breaks, is a proper use of the tool. Because if it's an improper use, to use it anywhere near any rocks, the damage waiver wouldn't even cover you. So we're assuming that that's a proper use of the tool. It's just something that happens during the normal course of using a tiller. So let's look at that. You're using the tiller. You're using it completely appropriately. The tine hits a rock and it breaks. Under the repair or replacement clause, this tool now needs to be repaired or replaced. So what does the repair or replacement clause provide? One, it says stop using it and bring it back. Two, it says Home Depot will fix it or provide a replacement. Three, it says you're going to pay for that repair if the damage was due to improper use. Well, since in this factual hypothetical that they proposed, the damage was not due to improper use, you don't owe an obligation to pay. So it's very clear under the provision of the contract that says here's what happens if the tool needs to be repaired or replaced. You don't owe any money. You know, that's the key sentence there. The clause says if the tool needs to be replaced, you're going to pay for it if the damage was due to your improper use. What's that clause doing in the contract? If, as Home Depot contends, you're liable for all repairs without buying that damage waiver, anything, you're liable for it. It's very simple to draft that sentence. It would say, if a tool is damaged, stop using it, bring it back to the store, we'll fix it, however, you will pay for all repairs. Couldn't be simpler. The contract would say that. However, they clearly modified that obligation to pay for repairs by saying you'll pay for repairs if it occurs due to improper use. So under that clause of the contract, in their example, you're not liable to pay for the repairs. We've also said that there's another provision that sort of comes at it from a different point of view, and that's the provision that exempts wear and tear. Paragraph 5 of the contract says that you can bring a tool back and it should be in the same condition you got it in, except for reasonable wear and tear resulting from proper use. Now, the parties have debated a little bit the meaning of that term.
Let me ask you, there, a lot of district courts apparently have rejected this claim, various states. Are there any decisions under advisement by any appellate, any circuit courts on this issue?
This is the. There is only one other appeal currently pending, and that is in the Third Circuit. That's a case arising out of New Jersey. That case has been briefed, but no oral argument has been set.
So we're first in line.
You are first in line on this one.
Okay.
Getting back to the repair, the wear and tear clause, because it really dovetails with the repair and replacement provision. One provision says that here's what you're going to have to pay for if that damage is due to your improper use. Now it's coming at it from the other angle of wear and tear, and it says if it's just wear and tear that has been on that tool when you bring it back, that's okay. You don't owe anything. That's clear. It says you can bring it back in the same condition you got it except for wear and tear. That means if something is properly categorized as wear and tear, then it's not something that you're liable for. Let's go back to that example of where a tiller has broken because it hit a stone. We tend to think of wear and tear sometimes instinctually. It's something that happens gradually over time. And here that blade of that tiller breaks right away when it hits a rock. But if you really think a little more about wear and tear, the very phrase itself, it has wear, which is to wear down, and it has tear. And tear is a ripping. A tear is a violent event. And so it's not just something that happens gradually. And you look at the definitions, and what wear and tear really says is things happen to objects, tools, apartments, lots of things in society during the normal course of their use. When they're being used properly, damage occurs to things. But if it happens during the normal course of the use, when it's being used properly, that's wear and tear. It's very consistent with the line the contract draws between proper use of a tool and improper use of a tool. We have multiple instances where they say if you're using a tool properly, you're not liable for what happens. If you're using it improperly, you're going to be liable for what happens.
Why doesn't the voluntary payment doctrine bar this claim?
The voluntary payment doctrine, well, let's divide it into the two theories that we have under the Consumer Fraud Act. The first one is one for deceptive conduct. The second one is one for unfair conduct. For deceptive conduct, it's quite clear voluntary payment does not apply if there's been anything less than full knowledge of the facts. And in this particular case, anybody who bought a damage waiver, if, as we contend, that damage waiver is worthless, obviously was not fully aware of the facts. And that's really just human nature, because the only way you could be fully aware of the facts would be to read the detailed boilerplate. So first of all, we don't have you're purchasing a product, and
well,
you're
no,
clearly...
Well, the law presumes that everybody reads a contract before he signs it.
Well, first of all, I've never seen that applied in the voluntary payment context. The voluntary payment context is where you get a bill, you see the charge, you know what you're paying it for, and yet you don't complain.
Well, that's what happened here. Your client signed the rental agreements, didn't read the operative language about the waiver, took the tools, brought them back, was given an invoice, signed that too, saying all these charges are true and correct, and I hereby consent you to charge my credit card.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like a voluntary payment doctrine case to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me talk about that notion of having read the contract and whether that really is something that eliminates deception, because it's really the same under the Consumer Fraud Act.
Well, to get past the voluntary payment doctrine, you have to have fraud, not just the sort of deception that is actionable under the statute, which is something short of fraud.
You have to have lack of knowledge of the facts. That's what it is. In order to be voluntary, it simply means you cannot have been aware of all the necessary facts.
Because of fraud.
It doesn't say because of fraud. It just says the statute is that it has to be mistake of fact, for example. There has to be a mistake that you didn't fully understand the facts.
When you come to buy or to rent the tool, is that waiver, the damage waiver charge, that $6 or something like that, 10%, is that already on the invoice? And do you have to remove it or do you have to request it?
Well, I can answer that question, although we made a claim based on that we're not pursuing on appeal, but I think with the record...
You made a claim that it was in there.
Yes.
And that it was the default position. And if you didn't say anything, you got this damage waiver. That's what I understood your...
That's correct. We made that claim. Judge Grady disagreed with that claim. He didn't say that it wasn't put in there. He said that there was sufficient information in the contract that you could figure out that you could have to ask it removed, to have it removed. But we're not making here that claim that's an actionable act.
Right.
But let me see if I can get back now on the voluntary payment. I want to start with deception, and then I'll see if I can get to voluntary payment. I want to first of all say that under the Seventh Circuit precedent in Cozy Iron, whether or not your reliance, that arises out of the situation where there's an oral misrepresentation, and then there's a document that provides the correct facts. And that's the...
We don't have any misrepresentations here.
Well, the face of the contract says you're getting a damage waiver. That's clearly a representation that they're going to waive some claim they would otherwise have. The very first page of the contract says you're getting a damage waiver for 10% of the purchase price. That's a representation that Home Depot is waiving some damage claim it would otherwise have. I can't see how that's other than a misrepresentation. The argument in the voluntary payment really is that you're supposed to look at that first page where it says you're getting a damage waiver, you're getting a valid, legitimate product, and you're supposed to search through the document to find other clauses that show that that clause really isn't true. You're really not getting a damage waiver. And I'm referring to the fact that the contract, you know, has two pages. There's a page that's sort of like an invoice that says here's what the rental equipment is, here's what the rental charges are, and then there's a second page that's the technical terms and conditions. I can cite, Your Honor, an example of that. Do you have the...
I've got it.
The supplemental appendix or... Oh, you have a copy of the contract?
I do.
Now, look on the very first page. And the one I have here, it says... It says down under the agreement subtotal over in the right hand where it's talking about the charges, it says damage waiver, and it gives a charge for it. So that's clearly a representation that you're getting something that has value. And I don't see how the voluntary payment doctrine can apply when the notion is that you're supposed to read other parts of a document to find out another part of it is deceptive. It's one thing to say that you're deemed to have read the contract in this context. There's an oral misrepresentation, and you're given a written document. And what the courts have tended to say is there's no fraud there because it's not reasonable to rely on what you're told orally if you're handed written materials. That's just not reasonable. We prefer written materials over oral materials. So that's not fraud in the sense that you're deemed to have read the contract. But here, the very written document you're given says you're getting a damage waiver. I can't see that you'd be required to ferret out through all the terms and conditions to find out, oh, that's actually a lie. It's not actually a damage waiver. It doesn't actually add anything to the contract. And where I was getting with the Cozy Iron case is to take it even a step further. There's the notion in fraud law that if you're given an oral representation, you're not supposed to rely on it if you're given written materials. But that's not true under the Consumer Fraud Act. What this court said in the Cozy Iron case, Iron and Metal versus U.S. Office Equipment, is that was a case where there was a Xerox machine contract, and they were told there'd be certain charges, but the actual written contract didn't conform to what the plaintiffs said they were going to be charged. As for whether Cozy's reliance was reasonable, we need not spill additional ink on how imprudent it was for Cozy to enter into a contract with terms explicitly different than what it thought it to be. This is so because the Illinois Supreme Court has repeatedly held that, unlike a claim for common law fraud, reliance is not required to establish a consumer fraud case. So in the consumer fraud, if there's a deceptive representation and it causes damage, that's all you need. And I think that if you were to apply the voluntary payment doctrine in the broad way that you suggest, Your Honor, you would eliminate the difference between the Consumer Fraud Act and common law fraud. Because what you're really suggesting, Your Honor, is that any case of deception that doesn't rise to the level of common law fraud is barred by the voluntary payment doctrine.
But there is precedent in Illinois law for applying the voluntary payment doctrine to statutory claims, isn't there?
Actually not. Well, first of all, the Illinois Supreme Court has never held the voluntary payment doctrine to any Consumer Fraud Act claim.
The Court of Appeals has, hasn't it?
There's one decision, and what that decision carefully delineated, Your Honor, was that it applied the voluntary payment doctrine to a claim of unfair practice, not a claim of deception under the Consumer Fraud Act. It said that if there's a deception claim, there's deception. The Consumer Fraud Act is not applying, but you can make a claim of an unfair practice without there being any deception. So it was very clear. That's why I was starting with the difference between the deception prong and the unfair. My time is up. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Counsel. Davis.
May it please the Court, my name is Dwight Davis, and counsel for Home Depot. The trial court correctly granted the Home Depot's motion for summary judgment because the clear wording of the contract contradicts the allegations made in this lawsuit. Quite simply, one cannot sue to recover Whiteacre when the contract that you're suing on says that it's for Blackacre. And applied to these facts, one cannot pursue a claim that the damage waiver is worthless when on the face of the contract, the damage waiver has value.
Well, I haven't heard Blackacre since law school.
I thought that everyone would appreciate that comparison there.
And I never thought I'd hear it in this Home Depot.
In a Home Depot case, John. Correct. It is important to recognize that we are here on a summary judgment standard, yet both sides are saying, look to the contract. Why is that? It's because we had full open discovery, and there was not one iota of proof supporting the plaintiff's interpretation of the contract. The Home Depot has never interpreted the contract the way the plaintiffs say. There's not a manager that said, oh, we would say that was, if someone brought back in the tiller that hit the rock, we would say that that was under fair wear and tear, or that was under a...
Well, would that be covered? If I rented that tiller,
yes,
and I hit this rock while I was properly using the tiller in my garden, and I brought it back to Home Depot, and I had not paid this waiver, I can't imagine Home Depot would, I'd have to be responsible for that.
You absolutely would be, Your Honor. And you would look to...
It was proper use.
Proper use, you hit a rock. One would go to paragraph 3, the risk of loss paragraph, that says you are responsible for any loss for any reason whatsoever. And if you did not buy the damage waiver, the undisputed evidence in this record by our managers, the people that applied this, they would say, we would charge you. This is paragraph 3, the risk of loss, is a traditional bailment concept. If you take my property for a fee while you have my property, you are responsible for everything that will happen to it. How could we do otherwise? We're renting hundreds of tools, different types, different applications. So we make it very clear that under paragraph 3, you are responsible for all loss. But if you say, I accept the benefits of the damage waiver, which is specifically referred, they refer you to paragraph 11, it says you will not be responsible for accidental damage. Now, as we said, if anybody had ever interpreted those other provisions the way that the plaintiffs would have you hear, perhaps, you know, that argument would be made, but they do not. And why? If you look at the two paragraphs that he's referring to, they're not talking about. They do not use the word damage, for example. There are only two paragraphs that the parties point to here that even use the word damage, paragraph 3 and paragraph 11. Paragraph 3, risk of loss, you're responsible for all damage. Paragraph 11, you are not responsible for accidental damage if you pay this, and you will be responsible again for risk or excuse me for intentional misuse of the product, which of course we would have to do as a public policy. You can't let people intentionally misuse your product and pay for it.
I understand all the misuse business, but
so look at paragraph just in numerical order. Paragraph 5 seems to be shying away from his wear and tear, but it is reasonable wear and tear. Again, the trial court got the analysis correct. While he could possibly, under the plaintiff's theory, believe that some types of minor wear and tear could, I mean, minor damage could be wear and tear, even the plaintiffs concede that not all accidental damage is wear and tear. Example, there was no argument here that hitting the rock with the tiller is wear and tear, because it now there's a prong is broken. I think in this record it would be $150 to repair that. That is not wear and tear. Go on to paragraph 6 that the plaintiffs now on appeal put a great deal of emphasis on. But read that entire paragraph, and it's not a long paragraph, it's only two or three sentences. It is really talking about who pays for the rental and under which circumstances will the Home Depot forgive part of the rental payment. Again, conditions precedent at the beginning, it says if it becomes in a state of disrepair, again, not damage, but in a state of disrepair, stop using it, a safety issue, to bring it back to Home Depot or notify us, a notice issue. And then it was interesting, counsel for plaintiffs did not exactly quote the next sentence correctly. It says, then Home Depot can repair the piece of equipment that you rented, or two, give you a new one so you can get on about your business, or three, adjust the rental price. Again, we're only talking now about what's going to happen to the rental agreement. And then read the next sentence in that context. It says, however, if it is in a state of disrepair because of your misuse, you will have to pay for that. And then there's a very another very important clause that counsel plaintiff omitted. It says, Home Depot may at its option declare you in default. And then you would say, oh, there's some effect of having misused the equipment. Yes. Home Depot can go on your property, can bring that piece of equipment back in. It can continue to charge you the rental because you misused its equipment. It can't be re-rented to anyone because you misused it during the rental period. So there's
I don't disagree with a lot of what you're saying here, but it's all such fantasy because no one ever reads these things. I mean, you got to you go and rent something and you get a 3-4 pages of all this rigmarole. Nobody reads that stuff, do they?
Your Honor, and in fairness, this is not 3 or 4 pages. It's actually, this is a fairly simple contract as these things go. It's only on the packed pages. Dare I say, I actually agree with you in some regards. No one would read paragraphs 5 and 6 because they have nothing to do. If you read paragraph 3 that says, all of the risk is on me, if anything happens to this, one would actually probably say, I need read no further. But if you did, you would not reach the conclusion that the plaintiffs reach, and that's...
Well, if you really wanted to read these things, nobody ever does that. And you would go to this lawyer who would say, don't buy the waiver because it's worthless. And then they'd go to this lawyer who would say, oh, this is very valuable. You have to buy it.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, again, the law presumes that you're going to read the contract.
And we all, the law presumes it, and I understand that. That's correct.
And
it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but... what we work out with.
If neither the plaintiffs wouldn't be here arguing that the paragraphs apply if there wasn't this presumption that people read what they are given. And perhaps that's another reason why it's important that there's no evidence that we ever interpreted. I know in their reply brief they say you don't have to get to the external evidence, and we agree in some regard with that. If on the clear face of the contract the language is clear, which we say it is, which Judge Grady agreed with us below that it was, but if there was any ambiguity, or under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Statute, if you have to get to these issues of intent to deceive, there clearly was no intent to deceive.
Do you agree that the voluntary payment doctrine would not come into play if, in fact, the voluntary payment was made as a result of deception?
That broadly, I'd rather not answer, but apply it to these facts. I absolutely do believe that the voluntary payment applies. In fact, if it doesn't apply here, I don't know where it is. There is upfront notice.
Well, generally, if I give you a voluntary payment that you extracted from me through deception, then how could I be stopped from enforcing any other rights I might have?
Because, Your Honor, here it is not, there is no allegation remaining on appeal that this was anything other than voluntary, that they admit that they had the opportunity.
Can I ask you a broader question about the interplay between a deceptive motivation or a deceptive act that would get me to voluntarily make a payment? Well, you agree then, if that is fact, I know you don't think it happened here, but if that did happen, the voluntary payment doctrine would not preclude a lawsuit.
Correct. If I can divide with that qualification, that if there was a showing that someone had intentionally prevented the consumer from reading and knowing, it is in fact a part of the claim that they have to knowingly go into the transaction and voluntarily pay, I would agree. But not only on the facts of this case, but now on the law of this case, it is that they are presented with the opportunity not to elect to accept the damage waiver. And then when I say in particular,
that's one thing. Just clear that up for me. What is that, the default position that you are paying for this unless you do not want it, or do you have to ask that you be assessed this 10%?
I'm glad you brought that back up, Your Honor. No, in fact, it is you have to elect to accept it before the contract is printed. That's our policy. That's what the undisputed evidence in this record was that when you come up at the end and say, okay, well, now you've elected to buy this. This is the damage waiver. This is what it would cover. There's a description of it. Do you want it? And then once the decision is made that I want it, you'll print it off and you'll get it. Okay. If you don't want it, it will not. And, in fact, this record is very good evidence of that because here the plaintiff, Mr. Ricker, elected to accept it sometimes and declined it others. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
We have some additional time if you want to use it. But you've only got 5 minutes.
Are there any other?
You don't have to use it,
though. Any other questions? Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. And we